Welcome to the podcast that's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Zimmerman.
Hi, everybody.
And our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hi, everybody.
And we've got some test results to talk to before we get into answering your questions, which, by the way, you can submit those as always at trainerroad.com/podcast. And we comb through them and we answer your questions here. But we've kind of taken a proactive approach and we're solving some of our own questions that hopefully you guys can learn from. On Monday of this week, we went to a sports, old Silver Sage Sports and Fitness Lab. It's a testing facility where you can get a variety of tests done, and it's specifically focused for endurance athletes in this case. And we went and got a metabolic efficiency test done.
Ooh.
Yeah. There's sounds a nice fancy.
Picture of you on Instagram.
Yep. You can see it. There were comments made that my hair was still perfect. Well, I had that mask on. So, you can see on that picture, what we did is basically we had a kicker and we had Trainer Road, and we had a specific protocol that's used when you're using the type of equipment we were using to measure a metabolic efficiency test. So,
and to just add on to that, we all had power meters on our bikes too.
Correct. Yeah. And we were using Power Match with the kicker to make sure that things were on par with what we were using there. And basically what we do is we're hooked up to a machine that measures a gas exchange rate. And basically we have a mask on our heads and we're breathing into a tube, which gave me crazy dry mouth.
Oh, so bad. That was the worst part of the test.
Easily the worst part.
Yeah.
That and the panic that sets in when you start to work pretty hard.
Yeah.
I had no panic.
I never.
You didn't start working hard.
I never started working hard. So.
I have the results right here.
We'll get into
that. Well, I
know
why I wasn't working as hard.
Yeah. So you put that on there and you just fill that thing with drool, which is gross too.
That wasn't required. Jonathan just started spinning it.
You weren't there for mine when she took that thing out of my mouth. Oh,
mine was pretty
like,
bad too.
It was like a river. Ugly. It was gross. Yeah. But basically you have this mask on, you're breathing into that. It's measuring the something called the respiratory exchange rate. So
the ratio
the ratio between oxygen and carbon dioxide that it's picking up through there. And through that, the intent of the test is to be able to tell when you are burning fat, when you are burning carbohydrate, and at what degree for each of those. So then you can kind of understand the
trade-off.
Different
wattages.
Yeah, and that was the key for us. It was all about tying it into power.
So as your wattage goes up and you put out more power, you burn more carbohydrate than fat.
Yeah, and we wanted to know where that was. It's something that we've talked about a lot, and you submit a lot of questions for this, like, what should I do to lose weight or do this? And we talk about the benefits of burning fat on the bike.
This probably won't help them at all because it's all so individual.
Exactly. And that's what we've discovered from this. Really, we've always mentioned that it's definitely subjective, N equals one type of a situation. And this is just putting numbers to that. And it is an N equals one situation.
But hopefully when we follow this up with our VO2 max test and another lactate threshold test, we'll be able to make some sort of correlations between all of it that will be useful to people.
Correct.
In general.
Yeah.
I think
some principles out of this.
The most interesting part is we also did blood lactate levels as we went through all these steps, which is very, very, very important, I think, to put these results in context. Mm-hmm. And what I want to see is, so I have a really hard high carb diet right now. 3 months from now, we want to retest. 3 months from now, we want to retest. 3 months from now, we want to retest.
Keep going like
along.
That.
Yeah, we want to keep doing this and see how our fitness improves, where these different, where our crossover point happens as our fitness improves. How does our blood change, our lactate levels change as our fitness improve? And then next week, we're going to test our resting metabolic rate. So how does that change as our fitness improves? As our muscle mass changes with our DEXA scans, right? Mm-hmm. We're like a total study.
So we're just going to be loaded with information.
Power and VO2, probably too much. I was thinking,
right.
So everyone else listening to this, you don't need to go this far. This is because we have a podcast and we never did this before. Mm-hmm. This is like interesting and we'll see what happens. And we do have some interesting results.
And it's kind of funny because like one of our, I guess you could say almost like a mantra that we have with like the product that we work on every day, which is Trainer Road, is keep it simple and focused, right? And this is the opposite.
This is totally opposite.
Other end of that spectrum.
But we're hoping that from all of this, we can get some takeaways that can better help us understand our bodies. But by relating all three of these situations together, perhaps just understand principles that could work for everybody.
Yeah, we're bound to learn something throughout this process.
Yeah. And one thing that I wanted to mention.
So far, we haven't. So far, it's like it's just
there's some confusion.
We've just muddied the water so far. Yeah.
But there's one thing that I wanted to mention, because I know that a lot of, every time we mention something like this, we have people asking us, how much does it cost and where do you go? You should be able to get these done in any type of like a sports fitness lab for endurance athletes.
Universities typically have them.
That's right. Yeah. You, as far as cost,
I would go to like a I've seen, especially with the VO2 max test, there'd be like a gym one that will give like, people will get crazy results. Like I see them on forums, they're like, oh yeah, it said I'm 82. It's like Lance Armstrong was 84.
Yeah, like your Garmin can guess your VO2 max, and that is not correct.
No, but even with a gas exchange doing VO2 max, there's different levels of machines, and going to a university would be great. Yep. This one was set up by a guy named Jeff Angerman, this lab, and I think we all highly respect Jeff. Yes. He's got a PhD.
Very good.
In exercise physiology.
Yeah, he's especially known as the mad scientist because he gets deep, deep, deep into this stuff.
Way deep. I kind of want him on the podcast sometime, but he does not dumb it down for anyone.
Yeah.
Like you've,
yeah, there's always a point in the conversation with Jeff where you just lose it and it all just starts going over your head.
You thought the Flow Wheels podcast was confusing.
Yeah.
You know, and as far as cost, it varies widely. I've seen cost for these anywhere from as low as $100 all the way up to $300, $400.
What should ours cost?
Ours costs $100 each.
Did you pay for it?
So, no, we haven't paid for it yet because we got more testing and she just said we'll pay for it.
Lump it all together.
Yeah. And that's one thing to mention is if you have friends that are equally as interested at dissecting or giving yourself a complex in the end, then you can probably get some type of a discount rate with this. Or if you lump together multiple tests.
So far, that's how it's been. Nate's been just beaming every time we finish one of these things, and Jonathan's been kind of dragging. So, and I'm somewhere in between.
So let's get into the results. Okay. Go ahead, Nate.
Okay, so here's the protocol that we did. We started at 90 watts. Every 3 minutes, we went up by 20 watts. And pretty much the machine, every 30 seconds, it took an average of our RER, and that's the respiratory exchange rate. So we'll just call it RER from now on. An RER of 0.7, you're burning all fat. 0.85, that's the crossover point.
Where you're burning nearly half and half?
Yep.
Fat and carb.
Yeah, and then 1.0 would be all carb. And so at the end of that three-minute step, so at 90 watts, at the end of 3 minutes at 90 watts, we had a little prick in our ear and she'd do the blood lactate. And then again, I have in my little spreadsheet what our RER was at the end of that, that time. So Chad and I, we came in weighing like 1 pound different, like really close. And when we started out, I actually had a really low lactate level, like lower than I should, which I was happy. And another thing to mention, here's the order of the tests. I went, Nate went, and then, meaning I, and then Jonathan went. Someone told me that Chad and I sound exactly the same.
That's crazy. But yeah, I guess so. The magic of radio.
If anyone wonders, Chad's the fatter one.
Oh, jeez.
I got 3 months to
say this.
He's the faster
up.
One, too.
Yeah.
This Chad guy.
Yeah, exactly.
So it went Nate, Jonathan, then Chad. Yep. All in the same machine. With like
same lactate recording machine, same metabolic efficiency testing machine, the whole deal.
Yeah.
And same sports scientist working with us.
Same trainer, our respective power meters, but we zeroed our power meters.
Yeah, Jonathan had a brand new Quark D0. I had a Quark and Chad had a Power 2 Max.
Yeah.
Okay, so I started out lactate levels very low, 0.1. So threshold, usually what they say is around 4
millimoles.
0.1 or 1.0?
I'm sorry, 1.0.
1.0 is
1.0. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Is around 4 millimoles. Aerobic threshold is 2 millimoles per liter. And I started at 0.6. Chad started at 0.8. And then all the way up to, let's see, then at 110 watts, Chad was at 1 and I was at 0.5. So pretty much my point is I started out very, very low for lactate and then it started to creep up. But what's interesting is Chad and I are... We were almost identical for the entire test. When we were at around 230 watts, that's when I measured 2.0 for my lactate level, and Chad was at 2.2. So actually, my blood lactate was a little bit lower than Chad's. Uh-huh. And then for the respiratory exchange rate, my cutoff point of when I started burning more fat than carbs was right around, I want to say, 185 watts, probably around there, because at 0.86, I was at at 190 watts, I was at 0.86, and 170 watts, I was at 0.81. So right around that. And what's really interesting is when I do my long rides, I feel like 185, 180 watts, I can last all day.
Forever.
Yeah, forever.
Yep, just give, exactly.
Very, very easy. And Chad's cutoff point was pretty much exactly the same. Actually, our 170 watts and 190 watts were the same reading, which is interesting. And then as we went up, we actually stopped the test when we got to 0.92. And Chad lasted 20 more watts than me before we got to 0.92.
He did. Yep.
So meaning that...
Probably says my threshold's a little higher.
Well, maybe. Actually, yeah.
It's one possibility.
So that's a good thing to put in, like, as we think about this, is it's all related to where your threshold is.
Correct.
Because if we put someone who has an extremely high threshold at that same 220 watts, they're going to be burning all fat, yes. Right? And you might say, oh, they're just more fat adaptive. No, their threshold is just higher. That's why this blood lactate test is really cool.
Yeah.
So with Chad and I, because I actually had a less blood lactate in my levels in the same wattage. If you normalize it for that, Chad was burning the same amount of carbohydrate and fat as me, putting out 30 more watts. Mm-hmm. So you could say that in that terms, Chad was more fat adapted.
Correct.
But there's a caveat to all this too. During the testing period, interesting was, so I couldn't see the machine as I went through. Chad was the last one to go. And as he went through, we were telling him, oh, you're coming to that cutoff point. You're making it. Chad, then what would you do?
I could somehow tone it back down, shift it more towards
weird.
Fat. Like I would lower my RER.
We would heckle him about his fat adaptation or something like that.
Six times over the course of the test. Every time they brought it to my attention, I dropped it back down.
Were you thinking of something then?
No, well, I think subconsciously?
What would you do?
I don't know. I think maybe I smoothed my pedal stroke out a little bit. I started breathing more fully. Mm-hmm. I got a little less anxious because you guys distracted me. That was probably part of it as well.
So I could see one part of it relaxing your body. You know, as you get higher wattages, you just tense up. And Chad actually writes in the text all the time, relax, relax. Mm-hmm. And I could see that your body uses less carbohydrate if you're not flexing every muscle in your body.
That's requiring
your shoulders.
Less energy.
Exactly.
Good sense. Yeah. So just a question of relaxing and...
And that's one thing I could say about your pedal stroke and your position on the bike too. Even when things are tense and breakaways are happening, you're always, it's actually visible. There is a difference in how you ride compared to most. You are more relaxed on the bike. Mm. You are more calm. So,
but in this, I mean, this was telling him to relax pretty much, and he would, and it would lower.
Yeah.
It was pretty crazy.
It is a pretty anxious environment too. I mean, having that thing stopping up your breathing, your mouth basically, your nose is plugged, you're drooling into this thing, hoping that spit doesn't catch at some point and choke you, and you got to spit everything out and the test is off or not. And it's just unfamiliar. It's new territory.
Yeah, it certainly was. Yeah.
So one thing that I like though, is that I put out less blood lactate at the same waters than Chad.
For he's now. Very excited.
But that's only
that.
One. No, it's only one part of the equation as we will get to Jonathan, right?
So, I'm confusing.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to Jonathan, our problem child. So again, Chad and I about the same. Our aerobic threshold of, was around 230 watts. Chad slightly more fat burning than I am. Mm-hmm. Although he did get to, he kept pushing it down. I don't know how.
he is the force or something.
So next time we do it, I don't know if we should all kind of know when that's happening or we should all not know when that's happening.
I wonder, huh?
Anyways, all that stuff's interesting. And mm-hmm. Chad, actually, she cut you off at a lactate level of 4.3. So you went up to 270 watts, you're at 4.3. She cut me off at 250 watts and I had a lactate level of 2.7.
That was because your RER got to 0.9, which that's where they cut the test, is when your RER gets to the point of 0.9. She said, okay, that's enough. We've noticed the switchover rate and things have stabilized. Yep. So
Jonathan started. And so remember, off the bat, I was 0.77 RER and Chad was 0.71 RER. Jonathan, right off the bat at 90 watts, 0.83.
So, and lactate level too.
1.4
versus 0.6 and 0.8. When she actually took the lactate machine to take the test prior to, like, because she would take a quick little test before you went, and she used it and she said 1.5. That's weird. And then she tried it again and she's like, oh, okay, I guess that's just where you're at. And then I started pedaling into things. So really high lactate levels right off the bat.
And you hit the crossover point
so early.
110 watts.
Wow. Which the crazy thing is, I remember, and remember, I went in between both of you. So that's the key thing to recognize here.
I know, I was thinking maybe the machine drifted or something, but no.
But I went between. And also, I remember when Nate got off. Now, it wasn't like Nate was, it's not like a VO2 max test. Remember, Nate said that he stopped.
No, I gasped because of the dry mouth.
Exactly. Nate gasped because of the dry mouth. But you were also working certainly at a lot higher capacity than I was, right?
Yeah, I was at 250 watts.
250 watts. Chad, when you finished yours, you were gasping because of the mask too. Mm-hmm. But you also got pretty high up into things.
290 or whatever, either way.
270, yeah. 270.
Yeah. And by the time when I finished, I wasn't even, my heart rate was at 130, which usually my max this year I've noticed has been 194. It's really low. In fact, if I do jumping jacks, it'll go to 130 really quick and just normal jumping jacks. So
for whatever reason, Jonathan just dumps lactate. I mean, it appears he's not burning hardly any fat at all.
Yeah exactly.
Exactly.
Pretty much from the get-go, carbohydrate. And here's the other interesting thing about this. We were talking about this the other day. I eat, comparatively speaking, a pretty low amount of sugar.
Well, that's why I don't think it's a dietary.
Yeah.
Low amount of sugar thing. what percentage of carbohydrate? I mean, what
not
are we,
a whole
are
lot.
Talking?
I'm pretty protein.
Yeah, we see what he eats around here, and it doesn't appear to be
a lot of salads.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of salads.
Yeah. So this is perplexing us, to say the least.
Yeah, and some other interesting stuff too. So after that test was done, so this would suggest basically, like we talked about earlier.
Salads, that would be like you are unfit untrained,
right?
Athlete.
So four millimoles millimoles per liter is usually what you consider, or they correlate to somebody's threshold. That certainly does vary somewhat. That's not like a hard and fast rule.
You probably would have hit it around, they stopped you off. So at 190 watts, you're at 3.5.
But I would have hit it around 200 watts.
200, because it spikes up. It, as you get closer to that point, it really accelerates.
So his LT, his lactate steady state, could be substantially higher than four.
Yeah, so and here's the interesting thing. So later that night when I was doing my workout, it was Mount Field, and it was 3 12-minute intervals at just sweet spot stuff at 233. And when I was doing them, I was closed mouth nearly by the end. It wasn't.
See, that'd be interesting too. We're going to get a lactate monitor so we can start actually testing. We can have Jonathan doing what feels like steady state to him, get a blood draw or just a little pinprick and see if he is in fact 4, 5, 6, who knows.
And
that's interesting as we have someone who works for us, Brandon Need.
Very high-end triathlete.
Yeah, and he used to, I think at the Olympic Training Center, right? He trained there.
Yeah.
And they had coaches and they would measure his blood every day and they would measure your blood while you're testing. He did VO2 max testing and they wouldn't tell him like what his VO2 max was, but he had a really high, he could operate a really high level of lactate in his blood.
He would start around 8. 2.
Yeah, start 2 was resting for him.
His resting blood lactate was about twice what you see in most people.
Yeah, which mine was at 1.5 prior to the test. Then once I started pedaling, it kind of dropped to 1.4 for a bit, but then back up. But
he said he could operate up to 8.
Up to 8.
Which is crazy. So I'd like to see what Jonathan is, but this also shows you why maybe like Dr. Coggan is really about performance as like the best measurement. If Jonathan would just do all of his training based off blood lactate, you would never get anywhere.
I would never get anywhere.
Yeah.
I'd be pack fodder at best.
Yeah. So you know you're training based on what you can do actually, right?
Exactly.
So if you can complete.
Well, he could train on blood lactate. We just have to know what his max.
Well, we'd have to
steady state.
If he read a book and said,
scale.
I should use 4.0. Yeah, exactly.
Then I would be done.
So he would have to use performance, right? That's my point is he would have to back it out by saying, what is my performance at? Yeah. And there's my blood lactate.
It's the same way, VO2 max. You know, we might go in and find one of us has a sky high VO2 max. Doesn't necessarily make us a superior athlete.
Yeah. And to give people, I went back and looked. So, I thought maybe I was like, what if my threshold's been wrong this whole this data like this causes you to question everything. But once you see it, but I looked back at my data and at one point with an FTP of 315, I had an average power of 309 watts for an hour. And then I.
But what sort of race was that? On offs?
That was just a steady hill climb going up rows. And that wasn't a race either. That was just a hard
but
time.
That's not today. You didn't do
that's
that
not
last
today.
Week.
I looked at this year and when I had an FTP of 290, my highest average power, not in a race, just average power for an hour was like 282. Mm-hmm. So I feel I felt comfortable in that point in saying that, okay, so the whole concept of my FTP being where it is, it wasn't that it was too high. That was my sustainable power was near where it needed to be. It's just, I produce more lactate. Now, granted, my FTP is, I estimate right now 270 by what I can complete for a different time, 270. But all that being said, my threshold probably just isn't that 4 millimoles per liter.
See, I want to see where you go from here. Mm-hmm. And I'm so confused by these results, because it would make more sense if, okay, you have really high blood lactate, but your RER, like how much carbon fat, was the same as us, and because your threshold's pretty close to ours, and but yours was way higher.
Way higher.
So you were to hit the 1.0, I would think, pretty early on, just burning all carbs, but you do these like giant rides all the time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't understand how you survive.
Yeah. I mean, the other day I did, I was telling these guys, I did 9 hours of backcountry skiing, which is nearly an aerobic effort the whole time.
Do you eat a ton that whole time?
And I didn't eat a single thing.
Yeah. You're a weirdo.
You're a freak.
Okay, so I really want us to do muscle biopsies, but these guys.
Well, see, that's another thing we're not considering in this whole all this confusion. Some of it could boil down to muscle fiber composition. So he could be, you know, heavily type 2, which means he's going to metabolize
more fast twitch fibers.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So that's a lot of carbohydrate, a lot of lactate,
and that's what I think. Chad's. So we don't know.
Not doing a muscle biopsy, just so we're all clear. Okay.
But we one of Chad's theories is that he has a lot of fast twitch. Mm-hmm. Fast twitch muscles use more lactate and more carbohydrate.
Correct.
Yeah, more glycogen.
Yep.
So my body's just producing what the engine needs, so to speak. Yep. That's what the engine uses well.
Yeah. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
So I want to see if, I really want to get a muscle biopsy, because I want to see if we should change Jonathan's like event type. Chad can just sit on the sideline, but Jonathan keeps telling me how high his pain threshold is.
I do have a high, and I'll do it. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see.
You're my boss. If you say we should do it, I do it.
No, I don't. I think I'll probably get sued.
I'm pretty sure that I can't make you do a muscle biopsy.
So, Chad, you want to describe what a muscle biopsy is?
Yeah, basically, it's a needle, just like any injection, except it's a really wide, or I guess small core. Or whatever. It's a
open
fatty.
Core.
It's like a fatty. So so basically I think they usually do it in your quad medius.
Yes.
And basically just extract a cylinder of muscle tissue.
Yes.
Little topical anesthetic.
That hurt.
And then drill that thing in. Exactly. And the topical, from what I've heard, does not do much to tone
it's
down
topical.
The pain.
It's topical. It's not exactly.
You guys lose weight on your next DEXA scan.
Subdermal. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Not that desperate to lose weight.
Again,
it's going to be interesting. And hopefully with so we're doing a VO2 max test next Monday.
Mm-hmm. And today is a Thursday.
We're doing a basal metabolic rate or actually a resting metabolic rate, a fine difference there. But we're doing that in the morning and then the afternoon, the VO2 max test follow up.
Yeah, true. Yes. Very good point. So the basal metabolic rate, that'll be interesting just to see where things are, for us and kind of have like a, where the idling RPM is, if you will. But then beyond that, we're doing a VO2 max test, and that could provide some further insight into the weirdness of my results. If I have something like a high VO2 max,
I'm guessing
it's going to get somebody bragging rights in any case.
Or it's like, it's bragging rights, or
bragging
it's
rights.
Like, what am I doing wrong?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
We find out one of us has like an 85 VO2 max and we're not winning national titles.
Yeah.
We're doing something drastically wrong.
If you're
wrong.
85, you should be on the tour. But again, this is like, if your fitness makes up multiple stuff. So how well you can work with lactate levels, excuse me, your VO2 max and your efficiency.
Yeah.
Those are like some of the basic ones. There's a whole bunch of other stuff.
Yeah. Those are just,
and
but
all
if you could, you got to win the lottery, genetic lottery many times in a row to get everything.
Yeah.
And then you got to know how to race your bike. I mean, it's,
and then have the discipline to train. And there's so many other factors. The one thing that we're doing with all of this though, is because these are all different data points measuring different things, is we're tying it all into power. Because that's how we can effectively structure our training throughout this. And that's kind of the main goal. I know a lot of people kind of ask, like, you know, if they get a coach and they get a VO2 max test, they feel like they've done something like super significant or something like that. But to be honest, it's really tough to structure your interval workouts or your training plans or anything else with just that information.
Yeah, knowing your VO2 max really isn't that it's just not that useful.
Yeah. It's going to help us understand some data here, but it's not.
It's fun for us. We're doing it because we can.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And oh, man, I hope I'm the highest. But I'm the highest because,
hope you're not.
I don't think
we're
going
to hear the end of it.
Everybody on the
and you
podcast
know what I'm going
to
say? I'm not,
so
not the highest is because all through growing up, anytime we do any sporting event, I've never been like the kid who does the fastest. Like the first time we do the mile, there's some kids who just go out and run like a 6 minute mile and they never train. Mine was like 10 minutes.
That was me.
I think it's all hard work and dedication and proper training over on this side. So if you come out with a really high VO2 max, it means like, what are you doing wrong?
Nate's tougher.
Not tougher.
That's
just try
what he's really getting at, right?
I just try hard.
Yeah, it's all flattery. Let's go into Richie's question, and we'll update you guys next week.
I'm going to predict this. Jonathan has the highest VO2 max, then Chad, then me, and Jonathan's will be significantly higher than Chad and me. And I'm hoping mine's close to Chad because then I will have, I will think that
fuel
maybe I
fire.
Have the potential, no, to get to like 370 FTP like you've been before because. Other things about us are similar.
381, if we're, you know.
Okay, if I get to 381, I will be extremely happy.
If I have a really low VO2 max, then I get to become a lab rat and people get to understand what the heck is up
with
me.
If you have a low VO2 max, so let me just tell everyone this. Jonathan used to race motocross, okay? He is a very good mechanic.
Here we go.
He doesn't let anyone else touch his bike. He's very, like, he cleans it off, which I would call inspecting. So Jonathan might be and he has a really high level of performance. So motor in the bike, right? Motocross. He just couldn't get over not having the motor anymore.
Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting theory.
That's what my next theory. I'm going to take a hacksaw to your bike.
You need an x-ray machine.
Yeah.
No, I'll just hack it up.
A thermal camera.
Just to be sure he doesn't have anything new.
Nate just can't handle the fact that I pass him in any race that we do.
No, I'm fine with it. I don't mind.
Just wants to understand why.
He just wants to understand why.
Exactly.
Richie, hey guys, in your vast experience with trainers, which on-wheel trainer do you find the least noisy? Cheers, Richie. Which on-wheel means you don't take your wheel off, you keep your wheel on.
Probably a mag trainer. Any mag trainer would be quiet. And then, Chad, do you know, like a trainer tire, those are always a little less noisy too, right?
Yeah, I've had
sometimes, those, not always.
In the comp trainer classes, when we put a trainer tire on, there was a distinct difference. And it did matter what the tread pattern was on the road tires. Some of them had, like, those Trek ones had the little T's on them. And those would actually pop, like this little snapping noise.
Yeah.
But, you know, those are kind of exceptions. Most of them were fairly quiet, but you put a trainer tire on and there was distinctly less sound.
You put a specialized turbo on there and your tire will disappear after your ride because it will disintegrate. But that is quieter than a trainer tire.
Yeah, so mag trainers are known as the quietest ones.
Yeah, which, what's a good mag trainer?
So
what's one we...
To a certain extent, I know I had a Cyclops mag, the one with a little dial that you can put on your handlebars to adjust there.
Yeah, I had a Blackburn mag trainer. It's pretty quiet.
It was, okay, but it really was not that quiet. A lot of that has to do with these spindles are not perfectly round. In most cases, they're very close, but getting something to be perfectly round is something that can be difficult. And a lot of mag trainers spin at a really high RPM, and the interface with your tire and everything else that obviously will make noise on no matter what on-wheel trainer, but they can vibrate and cause some noise. The quietest trainer I've used that's on-wheel is the Cyclops Powerbeam Pro, which now they have a slightly different design on the magnets. It's not as quiet. But the Powerbeam Pro just had a gigantic magnet, just one of them, and it moved closer to a flywheel, but there was absolutely no friction or moving parts other than that.
I'm sorry, Cyclops, but I do not recommend anyone buys the Powerbeam Pro.
And that's the one thing. And Cyclops even
The Ant, especially the Ant version.
Yeah, they've superseded it, right? Yeah. They have new trainers that are better than that. But that's the quietest one I've tried. It's tough.
I think the Kirkkinetic road machines are pretty quiet.
But Kirkkinetic has a mag one that's even quieter than that. That's the one that I have experience with. I don't know if it's the quietest, but the Kirkkinetic magnet one it's like the Neo. It's just, you just hear your drivetrain.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a quiet one. An option, I know this isn't a trainer, but those Elite Quick Motion rollers I've been on, they're quiet. They're very quiet.
You've been digging those.
Oh, I love them. Yeah, I've been enjoying doing workouts on them more than a smart trainer. They don't have resistance control. I shift and change around to hit the targets, but those are really quiet. The only problem is at high RPMs, one of the drums is like slightly out of balance. And I wonder if that's because they actually have something because the rollers are plastic. But if they're responding to, or they have magnets somewhere within that, I assume there has to be some type of magnetically responsive material for the resistance. So at high RPM, it does tend to start to vibrate a bit. But I did a workout the other day in our living room, and our son was asleep on the couch. So our 6-month-old son wasn't loud. So yeah, that's a good option too. Which, by the way, the quietest trainer we've all tried, I think, is, well, I think the quietest trainer is the Tax Neo that I've tried.
Yeah, I think so too.
All you hear is your drivetrain.
But yeah, it's very quiet.
Yeah, all you hear is your drivetrain. So,
and your drivetrain gets really loud.
Yes. Yeah, suddenly it becomes very loud. Yeah. Lee, after completing the specialty phase, what advice would you give to do next? My race season starts just as I finish the specialty phase, so I was looking to continue on with indoor training through the week to stay sharp for the weekend races. That's a really good plan, Lee. Mm-hmm. Any advice would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, Lee, that's exactly what I'd recommend you do too. Just maintain your... basically your Tuesday, Thursday schedule, or whether that's a Monday, Wednesday schedule is up to you. But in any case, you just need those couple days of intensity. So really any of the low volume plans, so whatever most closely coincides with the demands of your race, you know, maybe you're a crit rider, so do the criterium plan and just do those Tuesday, Thursday workouts. Along these lines, I do have plans to create, I think, race maintenance training plans. They'll be called something like that, which is basically what I just described. Just something that keeps you sharp during the week, maybe accommodates a Tuesday night criterium or a Tuesday night race, Thursday night mountain bike sort of thing, mm-hmm. in which you just swap the workout out. But something that is what we're after, which is just maintaining high intensity a couple times a week so you can maintain that sharpness.
Huh. Yeah, that's what I struggle with this is during those times, like in season, and I want to do road, mountain, and cross. Should I just try to like, you know, do my weekend, let's say mountain bike races and maintain, or is where I have like a little bit, like I take a day of rest and there's like lots of B races, or should I just like, I'm going to rebuild and do big workouts before and really like focus on the next 2 to 3 years and get stronger over that time? Because who cares if I get 8th in the B's rather than 7th or 6th
because I'm a little... It's
almost a quadrennial training cycle where you're looking at it from years out, then that would be a different approach. But typically when you enter the race season, all you're looking for is to maintain the high fitness you've built. You're not really looking to increase it at that time.
Well, I'd like to... So, because I have so many race seasons, so that's the thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, I can't just... I won't get better year to year if I just race all year and kind of maintain my fitness.
You have to pick your battles. Yeah. And for me, that's what I do is I just look at it and I would love to do great at every race and I'd love to be in peak form for every race, but I just look at it because I've noticed for me that when I get to peak fitness, as long as I'm not being absolutely obsessive about my weight, then I can probably go 4 weeks, maybe a little longer even at a peak, but it's pretty tough to go any longer than that. That's personally, this is an N equals one thing. I've also been trying to cut weight big time and stay and have my power to weight ratio really good before. And that only lasted like 2 weeks and I was ill. So afterward, but so I look at that and I think, okay, I have about 4 weeks to really kind of dwell around that peak. And when I am in that situation, I just look at the season and I try to let myself go up to that peak. And then after that, I'll just go back and I'll do some lower intensity stuff to kind of just relax and turn the volume down a bit. And then I'll come back into it again and rebuild, so to speak. So I just pick my battles.
I think I'm just going to go build all the way to cross or not build, but you know.
Yeah. My advice would absolutely be pick what's most
season,
important
yeah.
and make that the most evidently important aspect of your entire season or your entire year.
The other thing the reason why I pick cross too is because I will be the most fit at the end of the year. Like, you know what I mean?
You're also a defending champion.
That gives me the defending. Yeah.
Defending champion.
I'm going to go to the B's though. I gotta win the B's now.
B champ.
Yep.
Yeah. And then the A's will be tough.
It's possible though.
The guy who won the A's, I think, is a pro rider. Or he rode in the pros. I think he got like 7th in Hartford.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know exactly his place, but I saw his name up there. I was like, whoa.
Yeah, that's pretty high. Chad's question. Chad, once again, you can just ask us. You don't have to submit them through the form. But does the use of oval chain rings, example given Q rings, affect your, and he says in quotes, light kick over the top or 4 to 8 o'clock light pull through techniques?
No, not in my personal experience and not in that I've observed in other riders. So I swap back and forth between the Q rings or the ovalized rings and regular rings all the time. I've never noticed a difference when it comes to pedaling drills. So, and I can't think of a reason why that would affect it.
Yeah, there are a lot of different theories on Q rings and a whole lot of marketing tactics behind them too.
But as far as teaching your muscles when to fire at what points of the pedal stroke, I can't see why ovalized rings would change that.
So do you like them, Chad?
Do I like the rings?
Yeah.
Honestly, I can't say yay or nay. I mean, it's, like I said, I go back and forth and I don't notice an obvious difference in any case.
Why do you go back and forth?
I like the
the what do I have? Rotor rings on my TT bike, and I think they're 53, but they're an effective 55. So basically, it's like having a bigger chain ring. So
why don't I just put a bigger chain ring on?
I can, but I have them. So
okay,
but yeah, I'm not particularly partial in any case.
Yeah, I have round rings on my road bike, round rings on my cross bike. I'd like to try an oval on the cross bike, but I do have oval. I have an absolute black ring on my mountain bike. Nate's smiling because he's probably thinking about how that interacts with my motor or something. I don't know.
No, I'm thinking about something else.
Okay, but yeah. But anyways, I have oval rings on my mountain, or an oval ring on my mountain bike. And there are a bunch of brands that have different, I guess, like asymmetric rings. You can get practically rectangles instead of an oval. They're really drastic in their shape. The absolute black one isn't too bad at all. And basically, that one for mountain biking, my theory behind this is that it would smooth out torque delivery to the rear wheel.
Yeah, that's one of the most sound arguments I've heard made in their favor.
Yep, and for mountain biking, when you're dealing with traction, that's important to have smoother torque delivery. And also within that, the torque delivery to the rear wheel, that also ends up affecting the suspension bob if you have a bike with rear suspension too. So that's why I run one on mine. But I have to admit, I've never ran a round ring on that mountain bike that I have an oval ring on right now. So I can't compliment on like A/B test.
Whereas I bounce suspension back
frequently.
Totally.
Could totally be the difference.
Absolutely right. I would have to keep everything else the same. And basically what these ones do is the way the oval is set up is that it assumes that the most powerful point of my pedal stroke is, you know, you're talking like the 1 o'clock down to the 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock area. So that's where it acts like a bigger chain ring. And then through the other side of things, it acts like a smaller chain ring because of where the oval is angled. So that's how that works.
So if you want to know what I was smiling about.
Yeah, I do.
Because Chad always tells me how I will never beat him in a race. And Jonathan, you just did it too. Every time you pass me.
Yeah, you won't beat me in a race.
Someday I will beat one of you guys. And then
we will never
Google, I will give both of you forever. And I hope all the listeners together
to deter me from racing
can all come together behind me and put these guys in their place. Yeah, I will do it. You can drug test me. I'll be totally clean.
You'll need a motor to beat me.
It's going to have to be a clean win. I mean, performance-based, too. It can't be like one of us crashes hard and has to quit the race.
Clean win.
Okay.
One thing about, I know, maybe not you, Chad, but I know Jonathan. Jonathan doesn't do events that he's not good at.
Yeah. It's called I'm smart.
I mean,
I'll do anything.
I know, exactly. You'll do anything. But like Jonathan, I would go, hey, let's do a TT in March. And I could beat him.
Well,
right?
Yeah, of course. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Of course. Okay.
Yeah.
It's pretty much just mountain biking. That'll never happen.
That's why my claim is far more resolute.
I could beat you in a crit.
Nope.
You think only it'll ever happen?
That's a bold thing for me to say, but
Of all the races that I've done, I've had the most success in crits.
Okay. And there it is.
There it is.
The gauntlet has been thrown.
Well, no, I'm not saying. I'm saying between now and death. It's going to happen once.
That's a pretty big field of time.
Stay tuned.
I'm
everybody.
Not saying like the first whatever crit is going to happen.
Let's go into Evan's question. He says, I'm a content strategist who discovered your podcast before finding your site. So kudos on getting that right and creating content that's actually helpful and promotes a great product. Cool. Thanks, Evan. Appreciate it. Anyway, I have a really simple question about cutting and weight loss. Is there any difference metabolically between setting a baseline sedentary daily calorie goal and adding exercise calories in during training days? This is rather than calculating your total weekly expenditure from exercise and dividing it up over 7 days. I'm 5'11", 193 with an FTP of 218. My primary goal is to cut down to 170 or so over the next 6 months. I find myself cycling my calories in this way because I have trouble eating the same on a 2 to 3 hour day as I would on a rest day. And I assume he means a 2 to 3 hour training day.
Yeah.
Is there anything wrong with doing this from a training/recovery perspective?
So first off, Evan, there's no simple question when it comes to cutting and weight loss. So if I've learned anything over the last few years is that nutrition is a hugely complex topic. We've mentioned a lot of times now that you basically have to fuel for what you're doing. So it makes perfect sense that on the days that you're not doing a whole lot, you don't need a big caloric intake. You don't need to eat what you would. You don't have to match that on the days where you're doing a heck of a lot more work. So that much is quite straightforward.
Is that what he's asking?
Yeah, I think that what he's asking is basically like instead of taking, let's say I burn 20,000 calories in a week.
And he's dividing it up over 7 days.
Right.
But basically that means on some days you're going to overfuel and some days you're going to underfuel.
Yeah, eat more on the days that you're training more. Yeah. That's what he's asking. Yeah, do that.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got the right idea. So Evan, go for it.
Stick with it. Yeah.
It's going to hurt your workout and your recovery if you try to spin it out or smooth it out. And then on those days you're not working out, you're going to gain fat because you're not burning those calories.
Bucket loads of science on how you can do yourself in by not fueling yourself appropriately.
Something that I have noticed, I find it strangely easy to not to like eat a small amount on a training day versus a recovery day. It seems like it's harder for me to resist.
Yeah, I understand
resist.
The mindset, but as far as what your body actually needs, it's
certainly
backwards.
Certainly, yeah. We know that that's what it is, but just like as far as like, I find it harder to eat less on those recovery days.
Yeah, you're not doing anything.
I find I'm hungrier.
Yeah.
After a few days on that recovery day. And there might be something behind that too, as your bodies are building, especially if you got a lot of fast twitch.
Yeah, exactly.
And your body is rebuilding. So we're still talking about fueling for what, you know, in accordance with performance improvement.
Yeah. I'm using air quotes. I'm going to trademark this name, Carb Trickle. So I started a few days ago where I had the
Carb Adapted Athlete.
I hope I say this right, par boiled rice. And for everyone to know, I'm trying to do like a steady flow of low glycemic load carbs to try to see if that helps me rather than doing these huge masses of carbs at once.
Popeyes and hot dogs and everything else
hot dogs.
Popeyes. So basically he's just trying to even out his insulin response, not have these big old spikes in blood sugar and then big old troughs and big old spikes and crashes.
So I've found out that parboiled rice has a very low glycemic index. Mm-hmm. Like lower than brown rice, which is weird. And it's something to do with the way that they manufacture it. And Uncle Ben's would be an example of parboiled rice. So I've got a rice cooker in my office. I did this, 3 days ago. I put the rice in, and then every hour I have 100 calories of that. And then I add something spicy to it. I have some like chili sauce, which also spicy food has been shown to reduce insulin response. So I did that for the whole day, got on my bike, clipped in, power went out. So I was so motivated to ride, all kitted in, like literally right as I clipped in. We've had bad weather here in Reno.
Yeah.
Power went out. I then switched my trainer from a kicker to a Tax Neo that doesn't require to be plugged in.
Yeah.
Started going. We're in a basement. My iPad couldn't get LTE signal, so I couldn't watch a video. There's no fan. I made it like 10 minutes. Stopped, gave up. I felt so bad the rest of the night. I think my body like started to, I don't know what happened, but I felt like you would expect if you ate sugar all day, just like crashed and tired and horrible.
Like Michael Scott on pretzel day for any fans of The Office.
Yeah, exactly. The next 2 days we've had more power outages, so I haven't been able to do it. Today I'm going to do it again and see how it goes. So I haven't had success with it yet.
It's not cinnamon real poverty.
Yeah, I know.
But you're not throwing those seeds on fertile ground. Like, you know,
it's, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, makes sense. Andrew's question. He says, I've just finished Sweet Spot Base and got a 30-watt increase. Thank you.
Kaboom.
Nice work, Andrew. And I'm wondering what build plan to use between short power build and the general build plan. Reading the general description, I would steer towards that with the focus on strength endurance with some VO2 included. However, at age 52, I have read that more VO2 work focused or VO2 focused work is more rewarding for masters. As the descriptions tend to focus on what type of events your choice of build should be, rather than age specific, I wondered if you had any advice. My discipline is road racing, mostly club rides and sportives, but I have a few races lined up for next year.
Andrew, this is a good example of why I'm going to be creating master-specific plans to address issues like this. Doesn't really change the fact that either one of those would work for you because they both have a pretty good dose of VO2 max work and the higher intensity stuff. So from a master's perspective, you're still getting that higher intensity that you need to, you know, mitigate the decline of VO2 max and muscle loss and all those things that go, all those fun things that go with aging. Honestly, I think you could go either way. I would tend more towards, did he say what type? Club rides and sportives.
So that would be
I would
lesser
probably
intense road racing. Which a club ride can be as sprightly as you wish.
I would stick more towards general in that case, just mm-hmm. because the short power is aimed more at more explosive sort of efforts. Criteriums where you're very on-off. I mean, there do come big efforts in road races and whatnot, but they're not nearly as prolific as in something like a criterium or a short track cross-country race.
In general, you still get some short. It's just not all short.
It's still in there. They're all blends of what we need. They're just, you know, a little more geared toward more types of events, more types of, or different types of energy systems.
Yeah, you're still going to get some VO2 work in general as well. You're still going to get...
Yeah, VO2 work is always a component of my training plans. It never won't be. Yeah. I mean, even in sweet spot, you'll see some woven in there.
Yeah. So you'll still get that there. And I would recommend, I think general build for road racing, unless mm-hmm. it's a very unique type of road race that you're planning on doing that you're really preparing for.
But even then, road races are largely steady state efforts.
They really
are. With some explosive and higher end efforts.
Yep. Yeah. It's not like a criterium where the whole race is littered with those spikes. So... Irvin, I hope I'm saying that right. I don't assume you call yourself Irvine, but if so, I apologize. Hi, for someone who has only recently taken up cycling, great podcast. I have two questions that I hope you can help with. I'm a recreational cyclist, and that with a full-time job, four children, and a dog, I have limited time for training. In the lead up to Christmas, I tested with the 235 FCP, then haphazardly completed some of the sweet spot low volume program, interspersed with running and gym work. My plan was to commit to the sweet spot's mid volume plan after Christmas. Forgive me. I retested, and with all the Christmas food and wine that found that I have dropped 10 points to 224 FTP, albeit I wasn't feeling fantastic for this test. So we'll cover that point here in just a bit. My question is, do I accept this figure and proceed to the sweet spot mid volume, or go back to the original low volume for a couple weeks, then retest? Do we want to address the FTP part first, maybe?
So first off, you're banking all this on a single test, which you even admitted that you weren't feeling great. So my guess is, and the food, your wine, all that, that's not going to decrease your FTP. It might decrease how you feel for a couple of days, but the power's still there. So I wouldn't sweat that. You're probably still closer to 235, which means you can either retest or you can just leave it there and see how the workouts go.
Yeah, you probably just had a bad day.
I had a sickness for a week. I got another sinus infection. Mm. Hooray. Mm. But I've noticed every time I get sick, my FTP drops.
Like, sickness is slightly different than eating.
Yeah, and eating. Yeah, and resting. Eating and resting.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So he's super fresh, if a little fat.
But the question is, so I dropped, I'm in the middle of a plan, and I actually dropped my FTP 20 watts, and I'm just continuing with the plan. I'm not starting the plan over. Just because that happened.
Yeah, that's another thing. You don't need to backtrack. This is kind of, I think we broached this last week, where you're training to train. You don't need to come into this with any level of fitness. We're going to measure what your fitness is, and then we'll progress from there.
Yeah. Then he says, my second question is, I have been diligently practicing the pedaling drills and find that I can spin comfortably at 95 to 100 RPM, but fade in power. I can hold my power higher at 90 RPM. Should I persevere with a higher cadence, even though it seems to be costing me watts?
Absolutely not. So stick with what works. Power is almost always the top priority. So focus on, you know, what we're trying to achieve with the power targets, so that we're addressing the energy systems and the physiological adaptation that we're after. Where cadence folds into that is it's almost always secondary, tertiary. It's never as important as those power targets. So if you found that 90 RPM works for you, use 90 RPM. If you want to lift it gradually to 9,500 RPM over time, then make that exactly what I just say, a gradual process.
As we talked about last time, would, if you're a racer, it's nice to be able to put out power at 100 too.
And more, I think it's more goal to work toward for sure. But if right now it's affecting your workouts, trying to maintain that RPM, it's kind of the wrong order.
And we probably didn't touch on that enough last week, that basically if you are doing these cadence drills, but it's stopping you from hitting your power targets by a decent amount, then you should go back to where you can maintain your power.
Totally do that. So if there's like an interval where it's like 100 feels the best for me, and it's maybe really far into the workout, it's like, let's do 85. And I do 85 and I can't do it. I'm like, I'm going back to 100.
Yeah, prioritize the power almost always.
Yep, absolutely. Having said that, build up more arrows in that quiver if you can over time, like Chad said, gradually. So, Richard, do any of the training plans address hill climbs? Pikes Peak, Mount Evans in Colorado, Mount Graham in Arizona, Mount Achaia in Hawaii, etc.?
This is a common question, and this is the joke inside of cycling, is you call something a hill climb plan, and everyone wants to do it.
Yeah.
But it's not...
Because when do we realize that we're not fit? When we get dropped in a hill, on a hill, right?
I want to be better at hills.
So something like, I need to be better at hills. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And it's, and that's actually why I included this question in here, was because, I think that a lot of people will, if they're training indoors now, you're going to, I can see into the future, and you'll be riding your bike outside in a short time, and you will probably get dropped because there's always somebody faster than you. And it's very probable that this could happen when the road is tilting upward. And if that's the case, don't just think that you need to suddenly have a climbing plan. Really, the plans that we have, they're all aimed at raising your threshold, really, and helping you sustain high amounts of power for a higher amount of time. And climbing just really makes things a little more severe. It's your power to weight ratio really matters.
Now, climbing almost always is about sustained power. I mean, there might be little bumps, little kicks where you're doing VO2 max sort
sustained
of level.
Sustained power to weight.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a great point. And to directly answer your question, we don't have like a Pikes Peak training plan or anything else like that. But if you were to follow something like Sweet Spot Base, sustained power build, then climbing road race, or the TT plan, 40K TT plan, you'd be a beast on Pikes Peak. Yeah,
those are almost, anytime someone asks about climbing, I steer them toward the climbing road race because, you know, it is what it sounds. And then the 40K TT plan, even though it sounds like it's a time trial plan and it's just going to make you faster on flat TTs, what are flat TTs but steady state power for a long period of time, just like a climb.
And it matters, like, what's the really long one in Kona?
It's Mount Ikea, the one he put on there.
Yeah, so that climb takes many, many hours.
Yes.
So that, I mean, you're not going to be putting out your 40K TT power. I would say that it's like a century, right? Oh, yeah. Like, it's like how many hours?
Yeah, again.
6 hours?
It's longer than that. You're talking from the ocean. As far as the actual climb itself, I think that the Phil Guymon just went for it and he didn't get it. But I think
Rossi had the record for a little while.
He did. Yeah. I think it's somewhere around 13 hours.
Are you kidding?
Or 11 hours, something like that.
I know, but so
it's long. I'm going to pull that up.
Anyways,
here
that's like
look through.
A very, that's, I wouldn't be doing.
Yeah, let's never do that.
Yeah. 40K. No, man.
Oof. So we were,
we can start at a different point.
You two can do it.
We can start at a different point. I'll be like closer to the summit. Like,
okay. So I was way off.
We'll drive up.
I was way off.
Wasn't more like 8 hours?
It's 5 hours.
Oh. Okay.
So
okay. 5 hours. So like a century plan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then granted, that's 5 hours for Justin Ross.
Or 40K TT plan. I mean, you're not going to operate at your 40K TT power, but you are going to operate at a high percentage of it. And the higher you raise it, the faster you'll go.
Kevin Systrom, the founder of Instagram, he just climbed it not long ago. And I think he did somewhere around 8 hours. So, and he probably represents, like, he's a fit guy. He's a good cyclist, actually. So it probably represents what the majority of us do. And that was sea to, that was water all the
from
way
from the ocean.
We can do it next time we go to Kona.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm on board if it's more like 5 to 8 hours, but no 13 hour job here. No.
I'd like to do it in 5 would be nice. You guys have to pull me up though.
Yeah. So, and we were at, in fact, I climbed up over a third of the way up to the top of this when we were in Hawaii, and because we were right there at Waikoloa. That climb is pretty darn long, and I didn't see the worst of it. I only saw the good parts. Once you actually hit the climb, it gets steep. It's like sustained 13% dirt section.
Okay. I'm going to be the best boss now. We're doing it next year.
Yes.
Jonathan, find us lodging for Kona, and Airbnb. That will be wherever it is, but let's do that.
Let's do Mount Ikea.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Yes.
Right, guys? Everyone on the podcast? We should.
Yes. Yeah. And it'd be cool,
if anyone wants to come. We met some listeners.
We met a lot.
Anyone wants to ride with us?
Yeah.
We just, Jonathan, we'll just pick a day. It should be before the race.
Totally.
But,
you can join us for any portion of it if you wish. You know, it doesn't have to be the whole thing if you want, just a portion of. So.
That sounds fun.
Chad, try to lose some weight before then.
Do my best.
It actually might be kind of,
I love this.
That might be kind of fun to it might be kind of fun to like build up my bike specifically for hill climbing for that event too.
You're light enough.
You know?
You need to put a couple
We
should normalize those corners. Let's just
normalize the weight. We're all the
race
same.
Race power, low body weight.
I'll just find a way to make my motor a little lighter and it'll be good. Bryce, he says, so I've listened to the podcast covering strength training for cyclists, but what about for triathletes? The issue I'm having is due to having a two-a-day workouts every day of the week besides Monday. I'm currently in the high volume Olympic base plan. I'm trying to decide when the best time would be for strength training during a typical training week. This is something we cover pretty regularly, but certainly time to revisit it. So
yeah. And as a multi-sport athlete, this is a super hard thing to weave in. I don't know if Nate has any insight into this. If you've tried to factor in strength training to your triathlon training.
I have before, and I don't know there's so much stuff that just says do your sports and that makes you the fastest. But if you want to strength train, something else, and that's probably the biggest reason why strength training people are against it, is because they say just bike, run, and swim more.
Yeah.
Rather than like having to reduce your other workouts so that you can recover and take the time to strength train.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't see a clear cut time when you could insert this and you're going to get the biggest bang for your strength buck out of it. It's just going to be you're adding another discipline on top of the three that exist, and you have to figure out how to make them all work peacefully. And you can do it, but again, it's just inserting a fourth discipline. I'm not saying strength training doesn't have its place, and to not try to weave it in there. There's just not to my way of thinking, an optimal time to plunk it in there.
I'm going
to
say, if you do really, really want to do it, right at the end of your season. So you do your big A race.
Yes.
Take some time off, then do it a little bit in there and use it as like a transitionary time.
Yeah, as far as periodizing it, early season is absolutely the better way to go. Just as far as factoring it into an already very busy week, I struggle with that.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at like Jan Frodeno and what he does with his training once Kona ended, he spent a lot of time just riding his bicycle for fun.
Yeah.
And strength training. He did a lot of strength training in the gym or similar stuff where he was working on balance and stability.
As far as like mid-season in your build and your more race-specific training, then there's nothing wrong with core training, body weight stuff, and the stuff that doesn't take the same metabolic or physiological toll on you. There's still a lot of benefit to be gained from that sort of stuff, and you can insert that basically anywhere.
Totally. Yeah. Matt's question. Hi guys, love the podcast. I've been using Trainer Road for a little over a year and have seen great success. FTP from 260 to 294 and lost 15 pounds.
Ooh.
And went from Cat 5 to Cat 3 in one cyclocross season.
Bam.
Attaboy, Matt. Well done. When I ride on the trainer, I tend to sweat a lot. The sweat drips down and seems to collect in my shoes. That sounds funky.
That's a lot of sweat.
Yeah, I can wash all of the rest of my clothes. We complimented Matt. Now we're grossed out and laughing at him. But he says, I can wash all the rest of my clothes in the washing machine, but not my shoes, and they're starting to stink. I just bought a new pair of shoes and would like to keep them smelling clean. What do you recommend to keep everything fresh? Thanks. I have washed my shoes in a washing machine before.
Yeah.
And you get a wash bag. You can get wash bags at many places. They're either mesh or there's some type of fabric that lets water through, and you can put them in there and it works just fine. I would take your cleats off. Just make sure you have them marked as to where you have them back on there. And that's a good way to do it. However, you wash them in cold. Don't wash them in warm because
it's glue.
Yep, it'll cause the glue to come apart. And then do not put them in the dryer. That could be really bad. So, but after that, just hang them up and let them air dry with a fan, and you'll be fine. So that's one thing you can do.
As far as in season two, when it's warmer, I take the insoles out and I spray them up with a bunch of soap. I use a scrubbing brush, especially with mountain biking. That gets it nice and clean, and then you can rinse them off, and that doesn't damage the shoes at all.
Yep,
right?
Not at all.
Washing by hand.
You know, one thing
I'll keep them not stinky.
One thing I do, I've mentioned my usage of dryer sheets before, but I don't have, and I know this totally sounds like I'm unaware, but I don't have particularly stinky feet. I'm sure that's what he said.
Remind me to tell you something after this.
I put a dryer sheet underneath my insoles. A lot of the time, like if it's in the middle of the summer,
while you ride,
I just keep it down there. Yeah. Yeah. It's not a big deal. So
the weight,
dryer sheet, but it makes my shoes smell good. So every time I put them on, it's a nice smell. So
I just pictured Jonathan picking up his sheet.
Smell it. But yeah,
cool
that
spring.
That could be an option if you're looking to get rid of some existing funk, that could help. So, but yeah, I guess that would be also socks. You mentioned you're a cross racer, but I mean, if you are using socks or anything else like that, and hopefully they're absorbing some of that sweat and not just letting it pull.
Wool socks too. Switch to some wool socks. Yeah. That'll help.
Or even a taller profile sock that catches the sweat earlier.
Yeah.
So more, it doesn't quite more saturate surface area. Down to the,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You end your workout once it reaches the foot. That's
or just change socks.
Yeah, that's true. Another Matt. I've recently discovered Trainer Road, and following my initial FTP test, I've been doing the sweet spot base plan with a lot of success. Up to this point, I've been using a spinning bike with power data at the gym, but it doesn't have Bluetooth and won't sync to my phone. I'm ready to invest in a setup I can use at home, and I'm wondering what you would recommend for a mountain bike. I ride and race mountain bikes 100% of the time, don't even own a road bike, which makes trainer setup tricky. My current bike has a 12 by 142 rear axle, and that's 142 is the width, 12 is the diameter of the axle that goes through. And I may be switching bikes soon, and the new bike would have a 12 by 148, so that's an extra 6 millimeters. And if anybody ever says boost, that's what they're talking about. That's a boost rear end is 148 millimeters wide and 110 mil up front. So he says, and I want to make sure my trainer would work either way. I'm pretty sure a direct drive smart trainer would do the trick, but is that my only option? Slick tires for a 27.5 inch wheel are difficult to find. Thank you for the podcast. I love watching or catching up on all the old episodes as I sweat through my workout each day, Matt. Okay. So on this one with the mountain bikes, if you get a bike with boost, there isn't a wheel off trainer yet that has boost compatibility for a wheel off trainer. Really, it would be a pretty simple thing to fix. Basically, you would just have to have 3 millimeters spacing probably on both sides and you'd be fine. So if you can have like 3 millimeter washers with something like Wahoo's through axle adapter they have, which is just a really long skewer with a few cups and adapters on there, then you should be fine. I know Tax also sells one. So as far as wheel off, and then Cyclops, the hammer, they do claim 148 compatibility.
So there you go.
Yeah. So I forgot about that. I don't know how it does the 148 compatibility, but I know they've claimed it.
We've never done it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I know they've claimed
it. So look into the Cyclops hammer. Wheel off.
Yeah. Also, one thing I would recommend if you can handle the noise, a set of rollers that are good, not like a crappy old set of rollers. But
on mountain bike?
Yeah. I ride my mountain bike on mine. So, and it's not that, granted, I don't have like gigantic monstrous tread. I have like it's a Maxxis Ardent Race. So it's not like a super low profile XC tire, but it's not noisy, but it's insufferable. Yeah. And it's also no, on these plastic rollers, like what I'm using, it's no more noisy than a smart trainer.
Yeah, I've used Mac trainers to warm up for mountain bike races, knobbies on. And yeah. It's noisy. It makes a particular noise, but it's not unbearable.
And rollers, you usually have even less noise. Because of the fact that it's not like pressing into your tire quite as hard. So it's just your weight on the bike. So let's go into Gabe's question. Says, hi guys. First of all, excellent podcast. I give you 5 stars if I could, but I don't use a platform that can give you ratings. Sad day, Gabe. You can always log in if you want, but I have heard previous questions from listeners with very high power to weight ratios, and comments are made that suggested those listeners might be pretty close to their biological or genetic limit. How would one go about finding out their theoretical limit, a ramp test, a power of VO2 max? Is it even a good idea to try those tests? Keep up the great work, Gabe.
Yeah, I think we kind of covered this, and we're actually going to be doing it pretty soon. So we're doing a VO2 max test, which basically we're trying to figure out where we top out in terms of oxygen consumption. We can push that VO2 max a little farther and actually go past that point and get our peak power output, which is basically over the course of a ramp test, your highest 30-second average power, which is something you can compare from test to test if you're to repeat this test. But we've also cautioned against, you know, what do you get out of a VO2 max test? Is it actually useful information? So, you know, that would tell you what your genetic, or maybe not your limit, but where you are right now, give you some idea of what you might be able to get to.
In terms of VO2 max.
There's other stuff in the equation. So totally. That's it.
So this is going to tell you one thing, but does that mean you're going to be an excellent bike racer or you should consider bowling? It doesn't. So it's, it's good information, or it's fun information. I don't know that it's good information.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a test that tells you what your genetic limit is. And even if I did know it, I would either be disappointed
or try to beat it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to take it. I wouldn't want that. The one thing, when we talk about like pretty close to somebody's biological or genetic limit in terms of power to weight ratio, we're talking in terms of power to weight ratio, we know roughly the top pro guys, they're somewhere above 5.5 up to 6.5.
Yeah, exactly. So we know once you get into a particular spectrum that you're probably approaching your limit because people simply don't go higher, haven't gone higher than in the past. So based on the data that we do have on a lot of top level world class athletes, we can say it's not realistic for you to go past this point.
Yeah, and even also the data from us, which are, we're not world class, but athletes that make the most of a typical schedule or typical demands of life, we know more or less where those genetics, or where those, not genetics, but where those limitations in terms of power to weight ratio generally start to kick in.
In general, my thought, I don't have data to back this up, is that almost anyone can get to 4 watts per kilo. I'm sure there's some people with like a 45 VO2 max, which will probably be me next week, would be have a lot of problems getting there.
Yeah.
And then if you're have some good genetics, I think five. But once you get over five, you don't see a lot of people go higher than that unless they've like as a kid and they've just always excelled. Mm-hmm. And those people usually turn pro because they don't have to do much and they are, they destroy
that's
everybody.
Rarefied air. Once you get 5.0 and above, you're
even five. Like, there's not many amateurs that are that hit five.
Yeah. Right?
No, it's, but you, it's and you can rare. Talk to a lot of high level athletes, the best guys at the races, and most of them, five, maybe, you know, they're in that very tight ballpark, very small ballpark.
Yeah, and we're talking, like, you're not going to the Tour de France and asking that. We're talking about a normal race. So, and there are actually a lot of guys that you'll see that are riding on their sage wisdom and expertise, and their power to weight ratio is not where it once was.
Oh, yeah.
But they're able to, in a race like a criterium that's highly strategic, they're able to get away with a whole lot more.
Yeah, guys who win a whole lot of races, you'd be surprised at how, you know, relatively low their power is.
Yeah, relatively. Yeah. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for submitting your questions. You can do so at you can do so at trainerroad.com/podcast. Don't email support. just do it at trainerroad.com/podcast. You can find, listen to, rate, and please share this podcast on all the different platforms that you're listening to it on. Just search for Ask a Cycling Coach. You'll be able to find it. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you next week and have those exciting results. Hopefully exciting or disappointing next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.